Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Bonnie Warren, author with photographer Cheryl Gerber of New Orleans Homes at Christmas. Stephanie Stokes and Whitney Stewart will tell us how Cherish Family Bibles came back into their lives via the internet. And Gladden Scott of Maple Street Bookshop has recommendations for cookbooks for holiday giving. Bonnie Warren's been writing articles about New Orleans homes and gardens for such a long time, and many of those articles have been in the pages of New Orleans Magazine. She's the author of New Orleans Historic Homes with beautiful photography by Cheryl Gerber. And now she and Cheryl are back with another dreamy seasonal book, New Orleans Homes at Christmas. Bonnie, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
This must have been the most fun book to put together.
It was just awesome. I loved one house better than the other, and it was amazing, and people were so kind. And, you know, if you decorate your house, you usually are quite a Christmas person.
Yes, that's true. So what is it you think that makes Christmas decorations so special?
Well, you know, in Louisiana, and especially in New Orleans, we're over the top as far as decoration. Think about Mardi Gras. Think about all the things. So why not do Christmas? You know, people just love it. What we did in this book that I love, we have wonderful garden. We actually have 7 garden district homes from last year's Preservation Resource Center tour. But I wanted some contemporary houses. And we have some contemporary, Jim Monger, Eric Hess, Chet Porche. Their houses are so different because they're so contemporary. There's nothing in the book I love more than the fact that we have the Archbishop's house.
That's true.
And he and Joe Canizzaro have their own wonderful chapel in their houses. I just think that would be the grandest thing to have a chapel.
Oh, wouldn't it be nice? Mm-hmm. Oh, and there are so many places with multiple Christmas trees, you know. People love to have more than one.
There's a house on Esplanade, a very impressive house, and they have what they claim is the largest hallway in the city in a historic house, and it's filled with Christmas trees. Mm-hmm. And then I loved what Gail Benson said. They have a Christmas tree for like 7 children who are related to them in one way or another. And under those particular trees is nothing but gifts for those children.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Ooh, wouldn't that be wonderful to be a child and
have your own tree? There's such a combination of the elegant and the funky. And like most New Orleanians, it seems that people have taken traditional things and made them new or fresh in a way, don't you think?
They do that, and it's wonderful. I love the surprises. And when I went in the Archbishop's home, and he had a statue of Santa Claus over the baby Jesus, and there was Virgin Mother, I thought, how wonderful to be able to be playful while he's a very serious person. Mm-hmm. And then Brian Batt.
Oh, wow. Now that was a Christmas
over
house.
Over the top. It is. The table is courtesy of his grandmother and mother, his dining room table, with all the grand things that they had. So every house was special. Every person was special.
Well, one of my favorite houses, because, of course, it has one of the most beautiful libraries, is Nancy Calhoun's.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
And that's such a wonderful story. When she told me that library is exactly from My Fair Lady, the architect was George Hopkins, and he actually studied that and got it exactly. No, that's marble in English turn.
And this beautiful library with garlands running up the staircase. It is just so, so festive.
That ends in a cupola.
Uh-huh. Now, you also include a number of historic houses. And that seemed really important to you to show how we dress up those houses for the holidays.
Yes. You know, I have always had such an appreciation for our historic houses because they are treasures. And you can come from anywhere in the world to New Orleans and see how we lived in 1850. Mm-hmm. And they all go all out at Christmas time. You know, each one I love for a different reason. Longview's a treasure. It's on the cover, and it's a very different house. But I couldn't get over how people worked so hard to accommodate us.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part, we had 5 weeks to take all the pictures. It was almost an impossible assignment.
That's a very tight deadline. But you have in here the Borgard Kies house, Herman Grima house, Gallier house. It's just a rich, rich selection of those houses. But more than that, you have recipes and restaurant stories and restaurant decorations.
This, I just love that. It was just over the top. Mary von Kirkanowski, they have a marvelous house on St. Charles Avenue, and she does this wonderful party, and she does all the desserts. And I wanted all the recipes that I could to be original. And I called up, I said, Mary, I have to know exactly what's in the box of confection sugar. She said, you mean I've got to go to the grocery store and look at the box? And I said, yes, Mary. And every one of these menus, it's a Christmas menu with all the recipes.
So that's attention to detail when you ask for the
measurement. And people still do entertain in their homes.
But don't you think a lot of people think of restaurants here as extensions of their homes?
That's why I did include some Revillon dinners. I mean, I thought I really needed to put Antoine's Revillon dinner in there. And I wouldn't have done it without the Christmas tea at Windsor Court because it's wonderful.
Well, you seem to be having a good time this Christmas season, and I'm very happy for that. We've been talking with Bonnie Warren, whose wonderful new book with photographs by Cheryl Gerber is New Orleans Homes at Christmas. You can meet her Tuesday, December 16th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. Bonnie, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me, Susan. I appreciate it.
Put on my coat, head out into the cold, straight for the eggnog and rum and that festive cheese ball. And it looks like we're gonna party hard this Christmas. The holidays are here, too many parties all at once, but better too many than not enough. Friends all gathered around, full of holiday swagger. How did I end up wearing these reindeer antlers?
My friend Whitney Stewart is well known as a writer of biographies for young people with such topics as Edmund Hillary, the Dalai Lama, and others. Her most recent book is the very sweet children's picture book, A Catfish Tale. And my friend Stephanie Stokes is a journalist who had a long and distinguished career as an editor with the Times-Picayune. But they're here today to talk about something a little different. I saw on Facebook that both of you found family Bibles, and it just sparked my interest so much. So welcome to The Reading Life, and thanks for coming on to talk about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Stephanie, how did you get your Bible?
I received an email through Ancestry.com from a woman in Florida saying, are you the great-granddaughter of John Egan? And if so, I have something that might interest you. And I said, yes, I am. And she sent back an email explaining how she had found a large antique Catholic Bible in a thrift shop in Florida.
And bought it and taken it home?
She collects Bibles. And she was very excited because she said these are often valuable. She'd gotten it for $20.
Wow.
At the Holy Spirit thrift shop in Safety Harbor, Florida.
Oh.
Oh, what a nice metaphorical thing, you know?
So she said that once she started looking through it, she saw that there was not only the typical family pages where births, deaths, baptisms, and miscellaneous are entered, but also a lot of documents stuck inside the pages. Some communion certificates, little 2x3 prayer cards that are Victorian era lace, pretty things. And she started to feel bad that this was, you know, something that was precious to a family, and she wanted to find out who it belonged to. So she went on to Ancestry, and I had done a lot of research in the past 4 years on that branch of the family, and so she found me.
Wow. So Whitney, what about you? How did yours come back into your family?
It's a little bit similar. Ancestry.com. Also, I received a message from a woman named Babette Ballinger, who happens to also be a writer. And she said she had my family Bible. Her husband had found this family Bible in an abandoned house in the property next to his in Yorktown Heights, New York. And the house had not been lived in since the 1920s. He found a lot of old photographs and documents, and they gave those to the Yorktown Heights, I think it's a museum. I still haven't reached the archivist there to find out what else went to the museum, but they kept the Bible. This man died in 2005, but his wife always said, I'm going to find the descendant of these people. And lo and behold, she waited until this year, and she contacted me in May, and then the Bible arrived in September. And we have since become friends over the phone and over the internet so that she could tell me her whole story. And together we're trying to piece together how this Bible, which was in very bad condition, how this Bible ended up in this abandoned house in Yorktown Heights.
Wow. So tell us what it looks like, Whitney. It's a big, big book.
It's very big. I'd say it's about maybe 4 inches thick, maybe more. And in this case, someone had covered it with a cloth cover. The leather has really deteriorated and the pages have creases and cracks in them. But with difficulty, I can still read the information in the middle of the family's births and deaths and marriages. And that fascinates me.
And Stephanie, yours is rather large as well, right?
It's about 5 inches thick, 13 inches tall, 11 inches wide, weighs 15 pounds.
Wow.
I've never seen anything that large outside of a church.
Oh, now, Whitney, one thing that interested me was that you found stories about your family that you hadn't known in this Bible.
I didn't know about this branch of the family. They married into the Whitney branch, and I knew a lot about the Whitney branch, but I didn't know about this branch, which is Horatio Waldo Shipman, and he married Elizabeth Wadsworth. I did know, actually, that the Wadsworth were a big Connecticut family. There's a Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford, and I used to go there. There is a story in this Bible that relates to another child, a neighbor child. And if you want, I can recount that story.
Sure.
So my second great uncle, when he was 11 years old, was skating with a boy whose name was Edwin Stanley Griswold. I believe Edwin was about 7 and my relative was 11. And the story goes that was written in this Bible was that Edwin bumped my relative William and he fell into the ice. He fell through the ice. And then Edwin came and he rescued William and he yanked him out. So now William was all wet and they were skating back to the shore. And when they did, they both fell through the ice. And William was rescued and revived and Edwin was not. And the interesting part of this story is that I just researched actually just yesterday. I read it again and I said, Griswold, I have a friend, Joan Griswold, who's a painter. And I called her and said, did you have family living in this area? And lo and behold, she did. And so I said, well, I think your perhaps great-great uncle saved my great-great uncle. And on Edwin's tombstone, I found a picture of it. It says that he died saving a friend from a skating accident.
Oh, wow. Mm. I know. And it's written in that old handwriting, too, that whole story.
Yes. And so, it's difficult to read, but you really want to know the rest of the story.
I know. It sounds like the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life, you know? Now, Stephanie, you found actual objects. Tell us about the prayer cards.
There were maybe 2 dozen prayer cards, these tiny, maybe 2x3 inch cut lace, printed, you know, very pretty with little scenes from the Bible or saints or, you know, the baby Jesus. And the woman who sent me the Bible left them all in there, stuffed in there where she had found them, in case there was some significance to where they'd been placed. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell any meaningful placement to them. But a few had inscriptions on the back, and one was from Maggie to Susanna. Maggie was Susanna's youngest sister. Susanna was John Egan's wife, the original owners of the Bible. And her mother had died very young, and she was left to take care of Maggie. So I thought that was sweet that, you know, she had one from there.
So what did you learn from the album pages about your family?
Mostly it was a confirmation for me of birth dates and death dates and marriage dates.
Because you'd been doing research all along.
Actually stuck in the Bible, not written on the pages, was a card about Susanna Egan's family with exact dates that I didn't know. So that was very helpful. And there was a letter from John Egan's father, Michael, the original immigrant who came here in the potato famine, written to his oldest granddaughter about his family in Ireland.
Oh, wow.
You know, the actual letter was, you know, creased and ripped in half where the crease was. But again, it's in that wonderful ink penmanship that's so difficult to read, but wonderful to read.
So how did you all feel when you found these books? I mean, there's such a thrill to actually touching something from the past to a different connection. It makes things more real, I want to say. And yet these are intended to be very spiritual objects.
I have always loved to touch history. And even when I was a child growing up in Boston, I would go to Salem, Sturbridge Village, Plymouth Plantation, and I would touch the walls, not knowing, of course, that they'd probably been repainted many times. But I was hoping that some ancestor, somebody, had touched those walls and that my hand was touching exactly what their hand was touching. Even as a very small child, that meant a lot to me, and I would look for ghosts. So when this Bible arrived, I just wanted those ghosts of my ancestors to spring forth into my room so that I could have a conversation with them. And by doing this kind of research, you really are having a conversation with them, almost as if their blood memory comes through you at the time that you're touching something that they touched.
I can't imagine you getting in trouble at Plymouth Plantation for doing that, though, I'm sorry to say. Touching history is often a problem. So what about you, Stephanie?
I mean, for me to have these artifacts, the most meaningful thing is the story behind them. And to know that, as far as I could tell, they probably acquired this Bible when they first were married, 1876. And they traveled a lot around the United States. They moved maybe 6 or 7 times. And that this 15-pound book moved with them everywhere they went. And, you know, you can tell by their family record pages that there's different handwriting.
Yeah.
And that each family member, as they married or had a child, entered their own information. And even to see the handwriting of my grandmother with my father's name there. You know, just that closeness is meaningful.
And imagine what a thrill it was to write in that book when something important happened.
The biggest question that I have, and maybe Stephanie, you have this too, is when they cared so much to write down these details, and then they pass that Bible on to family members who continued to write down the details, then what happened? How did your book get into a gift shop or a antique shop, and how did mine end up just abandoned in this house? The Whitneys, when they left this house, that no one took the Bible with them. You know, did somebody end up becoming atheist and then they decided they just wanted to discard it? You know, I'm just imagining all the various scenarios. Or did someone just die in that room and take the body out and leave everything behind? You know, that's the question that I wish I could solve, because I find that so interesting, that something that was so important suddenly isn't.
For me, the woman who found the Bible in Florida, she did a little sleuthing on her own using my family tree and as well as her own research, and found that John Egan Jr., who apparently got the Bible from his father, he had 2 daughters who never married. And so when they died, they had no family to pass it on to. And I don't think the family branches kept in touch enough to say, well, this should go to, you know, next cousin somebody. Yeah. So I think that's how it ended up in this thrift shop.
Well, I'm curious, did the woman who found this Bible, since she is a collector, Stephanie, did she say that she'd returned a lot of books like this to families?
You know, I didn't ask. But this one, she seemed, it had so much detail in it that she almost felt obligated.
Well, it's amazing. It's miraculous, really, when you think. The Holy Spirit thrift store? That's perfect.
I mean, in some ways, having online records of our own families, I mean, I have it all the way up to my generation. That makes it easy to find somebody like that. I think it just took her a day or two to find me. But the fact that she took the trouble to do it is the miraculous part.
So is that what you think has replaced family Bibles now, those online records like that?
Yes, I think so. And I think we, both of us, would love to give credit to these women who took time out and thought it was important enough to find us and give them back to us. But in my case, I had nothing like that written. I have photographs of my family, and I do have a Whitney family document that was created back in the 1800s. But I think for me, I've always been interested in my family history and wanted to know the secrets and the glorious moments. And so, yes, I put it all on Ancestry.com, and it goes way, way, way back. But I had nothing else to, you know, hand down to my son. So here's something that will go down.
Well, something amazing and weighty, too. It's really interesting. We've been talking with Whitney Stewart and Stephanie Stokes about their family Bibles, which were recovered and returned through Ancestry.com. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Been asking some of our favorite local booksellers for their holiday picks this year. Today we're talking with Gladden Scott, who is the new owner of Maple Street Bookshop. Hi, Gladden.
Hey, thank you so much, Susan, for having me.
And Maple Street is celebrating a really big and wonderful anniversary this year, isn't it?
This is our 50th year.
Isn't that amazing?
It's fabulous. Fabulous. And, you know, it's wonderful because I've been a customer since almost the very beginning of Maple Street Bookshop.
So. And how long have you worked there?
I came 6 years ago as the manager of the store. It was going to be my retirement job. I really didn't think I would get that involved in actually eventually owning the store.
And here you are. So. Well, keep it going, baby. We need Maple Street and all our independent bookstores, you know. So what are you going to tell us about today? What are your holiday picks?
Well, nothing to me says celebration like food. Mm-hmm. And this year, there are an extraordinary number of new and wonderful cookbooks, both local, regional, and international. So I picked five that I thought really represented a great cross-section of new books and also various price points.
Great.
For people. So the first thing I picked was Kit Wohl's latest book, New Orleans Creole Cuisine. Kit always does a wonderful job presenting recipes by chefs from around the city, beautifully photographed, and with directions that are very easy to follow. Her books are a wonderful size. They're beautifully packaged and reasonably priced and easy to ship to friends and relatives around the country.
Homesick New Orleanians, you know, always need a new cookbook.
Exactly. So, you know, I just love this book. You open it and, for instance, there was a recipe for green tomatoes and shrimp remoulade by Joanne Clevenger.
Wow.
And you go, how many wonderful evenings have I spent at Joanne Clevenger's restaurant, and how wonderful to have this signature recipe in this cookbook.
All right. I'm getting my menu in order now. So what's this nice paperback cookbook I see there?
It's the Essential Louisiana Cookbook, a brand new book by Stanley Dry, who's a food editor for Louisiana Life magazine, and local photographer Eugenio Ewell. And again, it expands from New Orleans to all of southern Louisiana with recipes that are beautiful to look at and also easy to follow.
That's key.
And this is a cookbook that's easy to use. You can put it on the counter and not have to worry about messing it up while you follow the recipes. And just a joy to look through. They've done a wonderful job and a great addition to the Louisiana cookbook selection.
Great. Now, your next one is a big Southern cookbook.
I'm a huge fan of Donald Link. a few years ago, he put out a cookbook, Real Cajun,
yep.
that was just fabulous. And this year, he expanded on that with a book entitled Down South. And it is incredible. This is food that is made to stick to the ribs. If you're worried about your calorie count, then I wouldn't go here.
Go elsewhere.
But if you just want to celebrate the wonderful regional cuisine of the South, then this book is tremendous.
Those shrimp on the cover look mighty tasty, I must say.
It's fabulous. And thank anyone who knows Donald's restaurants, Herb Saint and Couchon and Pesh will love this cookbook and really appreciate someone who I think is a tremendous ambassador for the mm-hmm. city.
Support the home team. Now I see you've got two others there, and one of them is by one of my very favorites, Ina Carton.
I love her.
I do too.
Just like, she's my favorite of all the personalities on the Food Network. And she, of course, lives a very privileged life in this gorgeous home in the Hamptons, yet she makes it seem also down home.
Yes.
And her recipes are the same. When you see her cook, she makes it look so easy and so beautiful. And this year, she put out a book entitled Make It Ahead. And we're always complaining, I don't have enough time to do that. Where am I going to find the time? Well, she makes it simple. In this book, she leads you step by step on preparing for an event and with recipes that you can make ahead and store and then bring out the day of the event.
You know what I love about her? I love that she's so reassuring. I love that she always goes, how easy is that? How good is that?
Exactly. She just makes it so accessible.
It's and all possible.
You're not intimidated by her at all.
Mm-mm.
And at the same time, the books are beautiful.
Yes,
wonderful coffee table books.
So the last one you brought is really a coffee table book that might be a little intimidating.
This is really for the serious cook, the serious student of food history. Historic Heston by Heston Blumenthal. Just an extraordinary romp through British culinary history in a book that is a collector's item.
Mm-hmm.
I first became acquainted with British food when I went to the Tate Museum. They have a wonderful restaurant in the basement of the Tate Museum where they serve historic British dishes. And then also at a restaurant in London called Rules, where they serve all game in different, it's just incredible. And what this gentleman has done is gone back through time, through the earliest days of written British recipes, and updated them so you can prepare them now. And throughout the book, they've beautifully illustrated a wonderful history of the food and of the dishes that he's preparing. And it's a unique opportunity to really discover, you know, part of the history of England and of the development of food.
Well, these are great choices, Gladden. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Gladden Scott from Maple Street Bookshop, and Maple Street Bookshop is 50 years old this year. Congratulations.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tina Freeman signs Artist Spaces New Orleans Tuesday, December 23rd at 1:30 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, December 28th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Monday Night Writers Group meets every Monday night at Barnes & Noble, Metairie. And the Hands-On Literary Festival and Masquerade Ball take place December 28th through 31st at the Maison St. Charles, featuring novelist Joy Castro and creative nonfiction editor Lee Gutkin. Check out burlesquepressllc.com for fees and registration. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.